Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. I am here with Karen Pendergraft. Hello, Karen.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So we first met a couple of weeks ago when we were recording another episode for the Vendor Pain Points. And in that episode, we really kind of were kind of nerding out on a lot of our kind of similar ethos and kind of approaches and stuff like that. So I was excited to get you on here to give you a little soapbox to stand on and share your perspective with the world. So why don't you give us a little bit of background? Like, how did you get into the compliance game?
Started about two decades ago, working in the life sciences space, where we were working on on-premise systems, going through compliance, and a lot of the rigor around development of our application was not focused solely on regulatory compliance, and that became problematic as part of our evolution of that system. In doing that, I think I learned a lot. We went through a lot of exercise in understanding not just compliance within the U.S. framework, but globally, and how that impacts our systems as our clinicians are interacting with them, making sure that we have security and safety protocols and patient safety in mind. Going through that and going through the workshops over a couple of years and the evolution of that system taught me a lot about, you know, where we were going globally with all of the compliance organizations. So I got very excited about it. I was adamant that I wanted to be a part of that process. I'm very much a stickler for details and making sure that we're protecting ourselves as a company and also looking for patient protection as a whole.
So what was it about this whole project that got you so excited?
It was really because the end result was interaction of clinicians and clinical trial staff with patients and looking at the security and safety protocols with regard to that patient. That was always important to me. My grandmother was a trauma nurse, so I learned a lot about, how to care for the patient firsthand from experience with her and interactions with, her patients. And through that, I saw the importance of making sure that you put them first. So pharmacovigilance is a passion of mine that I've continued to pursue over the years.
So explain it to me like I'm five. Like, what did this system do? Like, what was it designed to do? And what impact did the lack of sort of integration to all the regulatory frameworks that it was sort of spanning across have on the deployment of the system?
So in a clinical trial setting, there are multiple interactions with the patient, even before you enter the room to, onboard the patient to the protocol. In doing that, the system initially did not have something similar like pop-ups and notifications to the clinicians as they're interacting or preparing to interact with the patient that helped them to keep the patient safety in the forefront of their interaction. In doing that and setting those pop-ups, those interactions, it helped us to not only be compliant, but to make sure that we were not missing some important elements of that interaction because the system and the software needed to guide the clinicians through that that interaction. So building templates, building pop-ups, making sure that you have checked all of the boxes with regard to a thorough examination of the patient. Did you ask all the questions? Did they sign all of the documentation that allows you to continue with the clinical trial with that patient, and making sure that there aren't additional concerns that maybe underlying conditions with the patient that you need to be looking for to decide or decipher whether or not that patient should be going through the trial or not. So, those safety interactions are really guided by the software, but it impacts how the clinicians are working through the system. Are you making contact with the patient face-to-face? Are you asking the questions to them and not talking through the computer? Exactly how are you interacting with them?
How has, Yeah, I would imagine that given the nature of these clinical trials where, you know, these clinicians are dealing with quote unquote patients, I mean, that's the obvious, that's obviously like the actual term for them. Though I think when I think of a patient, typically I'm thinking of someone who's going to their doctor to get something fixed or to get checked up on something. The nature of that interaction, to your point, is sort of outside of the sort of care, at least on some level, it's outside of like sort of a normal care type of an interaction. So I would imagine that it's, that's, you know, at least one factor in why it's so necessary for the, for a system to have proper guardrails to ensure that that interaction is going to give you, you know, a controlled kind of result that you can feed into the broader trial.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and there was less of, there was less of that leaning on all of the regulatory compliance at the time, but more about how we were evolving, because this was a couple of decades ago and things have changed significantly since then, both with the technology platforms that are available to these clinical trial teams and with the evolution of patient privacy and all of those things that, that have to be a part of what we're doing today. So it's been an evolution.
Sure. And then, you know, building that kind of initial framework that allows for those pop-ups and allows for those things that I call kind of guardrails, and then deploying that on a system that's across multiple jurisdictions probably is a whole new dimension of complexity that needs to be incorporated on a really like repeatable basis with no errors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, making sure that, you know, if this is a homegrown system, that you're taking all these things into consideration. And also, you know, as you're using software solutions provided by a vendor, the same protocols need to be in place. So, you know, are you as a client of that vendor, making sure that that vendor is implementing those things that are of critical importance to your protocol?
Yeah, because for something this complex, the odds of you doing it 100% in-house are extremely low. You're going to be leaning on people in various capacities, depending on what the sort of sub-project is. So, you know, you're kind of in this really unique position that I think is a, it's a kind of archetype, or it's at least a picture of several different intersection points that the broader compliance game is going through, I think. So you're building a system, or you're sort of administering a system that is used to be like, in, you know, it's used to guide the behaviors of the people, you know, of the boots on the ground across multiple jurisdictions. So you have to balance, you know, that piece of it. And then you also have to work with all these different operations folks to make sure that it's actually usable, right? A lot of folks we talk to, under no fault of their own, you know, they're kind of on the other end of the chasm many times from like operations. They're in their, you know, they're in their office and they're working on their policies and they're putting out their regulatory fires and, you know, they're doing all their kind of compliance work. And sometimes there's this disconnect between sort of the compliance department and, you know, the hands of the organization, in this case, these clinicians. So as you've had to sort of span that chasm or build that bridge across and sort of be on that sort of operational side, what insights have you found in like how to interact more effectively with those people who maybe aren't compliance minded, they're more, you know, clinical minded, clinically minded or patient minded or something like that. Like, how do you communicate in a way that's compelling, that drives the influence that's going to cause them to say, okay, wow, this, you know, I need to use this tool to do my job better. You understand my question?
Absolutely. So I can tell you just from the perspective of interaction with those multiple functions, you have people kind of in an office environment who have an idea of how things operate and how they should operate, but may or may not have been heavily involved in the clinical side, so operations, as you say. And there has been a huge disconnect. And in order for systems to function effectively, both at the top level from a management and viewpoint perspective and down in the trenches with those that are actually using it, you have to have you know, workshops and sessions, and you have to get your feet on the ground into where the clinicians are actually working to understand the dynamics of those systems and how they need to interact with them in order to be effective. And, you know, with protocols, depending on the number of patients or, you know, numbers they're dealing with, they could have a very short time frame to interact with that patient. So if that system is not intuitive, if it is, multiple clicks to carry through the same operation, it has an impact on their day-to-day. So all of those things have an impact on how effective the system is in the day-to-day operation. And then the safety protocols that need to be on the back end have to be taken into consideration with that as well. So if they're going through 4 or 5 clicks to do an operation that previously only took them 1 or 2, that becomes a concern functionally. So making sure that those people are involved in the development of that software solution or the configuration nowadays with commercial off the shelf or systems that are coming out of the box, and you want to tailor it to how your interactions are. It's very, very important that those things are taken into consideration. So, time calculations, how long does it take from start to finish for that interaction? Is that an effective way to manage a protocol? Is there a better way to do that? And that kind of brings me to kind of where we are now with a lot of the cloud solutions and a lot of organizations that are running super lean with their teams. They may not have in-shop development houses. They are heavily leaning on commercial off-the-shelf and SaaS and cloud-based solutions that is to their benefit to interact with these companies, these vendors, in perfecting their applications commercially. And that's where a lot of the approaches that I've taken over the last few years are to partner with them to improve their product rather than make it customized to the organization. You work with that vendor to develop a product that is more intuitive. And those have proven to be more cost effective because you are able to lean more heavily on the vendor's validation documentation.
Right.
You're not having to be burdened by that within your organization. There are opportunities where the application can simply have work instructions and user instructions and standard operating procedures to cover some of the validation of that system, rather than having to constantly retest in-house,
right.
Writing test scripts and interaction with users and those things that, if you overcome them up front, it makes your life more functionally better with regard to how that system upgrades and interacts. And that kind of starts with vendor contracting, making sure that it's very clear when you're signing on the dotted line that you're holding that vendor accountable, that system is going to be continuously validated. You're going to have a continuous release cycle of improvement, and how those updates and releases are going to be pushed out so that you as an organization are not overwhelmed with the sheer validation of it from end to end.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, it's kind of on you for it to be validated, and it's on you for whatever you deploy to like achieve whatever goal you're trying to achieve.
Absolutely.
So I find it kind of interesting, I guess in general in life, it seems like many innovations in retrospect seem very obvious. And, you have had to kind of lean on the innovation, as I'll call it, of collaboration. It's odd to say that collaboration is an innovation for compliance, but just due to the operational nature and the operational implications on a day-to-day basis for such a sort of important or sort of critical element of your broader business, it forced you to kind of get into that collaboration mode and sort of employ a fair process with the people who are going to be using it to gain their insights. So not only does the system perform better, but the users take to the system at a deeper level and they actually use it, right? And then I just find it interesting that you've been able to sort of say, oh wow, well that collaboration really worked kind of in-house on my projects. I'm gonna bring that over to my vendors to kind of get the best of both worlds because so much has changed over the last 10 or 15 years.
Absolutely. And there are vendors out there that are really just trying to get into the GXP arena. And in order to do that, it requires them to be willing to do a heavy lift to stay up to date with compliance initiatives globally. A clinical research organization or a pharmaceutical company is not just footprinted in one country. They have to deal with protocols that are set up in multiple countries. So making sure that vendor is willing to stay compliant, that they're committed to providing that supporting documentation, and making sure that they are ahead of the curve as those initiatives are being rolled out or the regulatory requirements are changing, that they are willing to be forthcoming with all of the evidence of that validation.
So as you think about, you know, like there's the need for partnerships at this point, right? Like you yes. referenced these lean teams. I kind of referenced the, you know, broader kind of battle that compliance is fighting in general, where we think that we can be a bigger strategic asset in our organizations, but there's some light bulbs that haven't turned on yet at the top. In the context of all of that, can you give me some like insights or like, why do you think I refer to this as an innovation? Like, why is this so difficult for people to get on the same side of the fence as sort of their vendor? And how do you think about sort of a compliance vendor on a spectrum of sort of partnership? How do you think about that type of a partnership differently than something like, you know, who you choose to do your paper shredding or something like that?
Yeah, and I think a lot of this comes from organizations, especially more mature organizations that have been in business for a very long time. Some of their leaders at the top are a little bit old school in their perception of their engagement with their vendors. A lot of it is, you know, privacy and non-disclosure that is preventing them from enabling those collaborations and partnerships. And as a result, it's costing these organizations time and money and getting, you know, getting their systems to the user hands. And that's the challenge that I'm seeing across the board. I see more junior companies that are very innovative. They have, I would say, a younger team of resources that are wanting to constantly be ahead of the curve in getting their product to market. They recognize that these systems have to enable that. So trying to overcome that within organizations has been a bit of a challenge. And I see a lot of companies, an example is Microsoft, offering grants to get companies to migrate to the cloud just because it makes them more nimble and flexible and they can move and change more quickly. So those movements are in the right direction. We just need to get these research organizations to be in the same place.
So you said many of these sort of older organizations that have management teams that are a little bit more old school. What do you mean by that?
They are passionate about what they do from a research perspective. They recognize the need to get their products to market, but they are still most concerned with privacy, you know, confidentially protecting their assets, and they interpret you know, vendor collaboration as an opportunity to expose that, and they don't want to put themselves in that position.
So it's kind of a fear of loss that kind of preventing a collaboration.
Absolutely. So their appetite for, you know, accepting these collaborative opportunities can sometimes prevent them from being nimble in the environment that they're in.
Right. So how, like, what do you think that's rooted in? Like, why have those light bulbs not turned on? And what caused you to get comfortable with the privacy piece to allow you to sort of take advantage of these collaborative opportunities?
Well, I think it really started with a large pharmaceutical organization I was with in the past that had been in business for decades. They had done brilliant work in oncology and vaccine research and had put some very valuable products out in the market that saved lives. Mm-hmm. In doing that, they had, you know, placed their bets on a new product that was coming out. And I don't know how much you know about the instability of that whole process. If they don't get FDA approval, it's a deal breaker. And those deal breakers can actually bring them to their knees. And that's kind of what happened with this organization, where they were at the mercy of reducing their technology platform to moving it to the cloud in order to they were downsizing because they had taken a major hit with this rejection. And the only way that they could continue to operate is to find efficiencies in their processes, to you know, get into more cloud environments, reduce the overhead of hardware management and having to have, you know, technical expertise in-house to manage all of those things for them, and had slowly started making that evolution towards leaning on their vendors and feeling safe and comfortable with what they were doing.
So, I mean, in short, it's like they were forced to kind of get comfortable with it. And it seems, I'm kind of inferring this, but it seems like the fear was maybe a little bit outsized or something.
Yes, I think so. And once they got there, they said, this is not that bad. And as a result of going through this process, look what we did. We reduced our technology footprint by half. We're reducing licensing agreements. We're reducing maintenance of hardware. We're reducing having to have people in-house. So as a result, we can spend more money on the brilliant work we do in research.
Right.
So it was a light bulb for them in that process. And, you know, I think that that's kind of what got me to that place to feel completely comfortable with, this is the right way to go.
Yeah.
There's a right way to do it, but this is the right way to go. And now I think the challenge that we have with these organizations is to work with regulators to find an easier path for compliance, for, you know, their SDLC packages and their data privacy and their, risk management of these systems. I think working with those regulators and saying, hey, you know, if this is a SaaS cloud-based product and the vendor is compliant, the vendor has done their due diligence to prove that their system is continually compliant, then we can step back and say, we signed on the dotted line, here's the package that we got as a result of this. And we don't have to be concerned with having that continue to operate.
Yeah, because it's not like it's not a risk. It's not like these people are idiots for thinking that this is a potential, you know, chink in the armor or something, right?
Absolutely.
But to your point, like sometimes when you're forced to do it, you can say, okay, well, I was a little bit too worried about this. And in doing so, I can kind of move more quickly or, you know, siphon more resources to the areas that are going to make a bigger difference. This is just kind of navel gazing a little bit, but like, you know, I'm just kind of fascinated by how hard it is to turn light bulbs on at the top. It's just a very bizarre thing. And I just don't know what it's based on. Is it a generational thing? Is it a personality type thing? It's probably not that. Is it, what is it? You know, because like, that's a very compelling story. I've seen, we have different pictures of that type of story all over the place in our lives. And I just wonder why, you know, somebody at the top whose light bulb is not on, who can't get comfortable with the privacy thing and thus is kind of shackling their operations in terms of its efficiency, in terms of the speed, nimbleness, all that stuff, why they can't just hear a story like this and say, oh my gosh, well, how are they able to get comfortable with it? Wow, they've really accelerated past us. I need to kind of get over this thing. What is that thing? What is that fear that's keeping us sort of static or stagnated in this old mentality?
Well, I think some of it is going to come with what I mentioned before, with working with regulators, having regulators help us to set the standards with regard to these vendors and having, you know, putting accountability fully on these vendors and making sure that in the documentation, it is saying this vendor is fully accountable. If these are the protocols that they put into place to make sure that, the security there is there, the privacy is there, user management is there. Obviously, user management is a critical component because a lot of the breaches that have happened from former resources working within those organizations that have left the organization under bitter terms. So, I was looking at the more recent study of security protocols and these breaches, data breaches, and they were saying that 37% of these data breaches are caused by that very scenario. And I know they're continuing to research this, but it is something that, regulators have already recognized is an issue. And user management, audit trail functionality, all of those things are a part of the regulatory requirements now, because those had kind of been, oh, do you have a standard operating procedure for user management? You do? Check the box. That's not the case anymore. They're wanting you to prove and show evidence that all of those things are in place and they will stay in place. even in the event that the system goes down and comes back up, that you've got protocols that prevent those things from happening.
Yeah, it's this kind of interesting thing. You know, again, you know, we can learn so much from history, but there's kind of a picture of this broad thing that we're talking about where everyone's working in isolation, right? The compliance team's working in isolation from the ops team. They're building a system that the ops team just has to sort of swallow and just kind of deal with it. Hey, it hits, it checks the boxes. It's going to keep us out of trouble. Figure it out. You got the vendors, you know, working in isolation, not in many cases, not even collaborating. They're trying to kind of infer from these regulations that also were written in isolation. How should I solve this problem with my system and my technology? You know what I'm saying? It's like there's all these connection points that should be occurring. There's all this collaboration that should be occurring so that the solution that actually gets deployed can actually, you know, solve these different constituents, you know, needs or whatever. And it just kind of reminds me of that story about the Challenger explosion, where all those teams who were building the shuttle, you're going to see my, I know nothing about this, so I'm going to use some bad terms here, but like all those teams who were building the shuttle, you had the engineers over here and they were building their piece. And then you had the guys doing the fuel systems over here and it got, you know, and they just kind of assembled the whole thing and it didn't work, obviously, right? Like it didn't communicate yes. to each other and stuff like that because everybody was in their own little silos and cubbyholes. And yet the same thing is happening in our organizations around things that are super critical. Like, you know, in your case, patient care and patient safety. And, you know, are these clinical trials going to endanger any lives beyond sort of the sort of risks that we've outlined in sort of doing the test? It's just a very bizarre thing. And I think just like anything else, the more we can knock down these walls in these complex systems that we're all a part of and actually drive some of that collaboration, the higher the likelihood that the solutions that we deploy are going to meet the needs and, you know, check our boxes and keep us safe and so forth.
Absolutely. And I think that this needs to be a standard operating procedure for organizations like this that say that continuous improvement and collaboration are an essential component of how we operate as a company. Without that, I think they are losing sight of the handicaps that they put in front of themselves. So, you know, I try with every program that I manage, and all of them have been GXP related, to do a continuous improvement where no matter what we're doing in that operation, we are engaging with these other functional resources and making sure that we are taking into account how these things may impact them, making sure that not just from their leadership, but from the boots on the ground, as we said, are interacting in this continuous process improvement and doing a sample set of different resources periodically to make sure that you're getting feedback with multiple perspectives. I think it's very, very important.
Yeah, so it's almost like what you're kind of proposing. I guess, let me ask you this way. When you think about continuous improvement, do you think about that as a project? Or do you think about it more on the other end of the spectrum as like a mindset or just a...
It's an operational methodology. It should be an operational methodology. It should be a part of everything you do. And it doesn't just impact you as an organization. It impacts how your clients see you, how regulators see you. If they see that you operate under that continuous improvement model with regard to... You know, basic on the ground. How does HR interact with employees when they handle complaints? Is there a continuous improvement process as a part of that? Are they taking that feedback and putting it into a functional plan to resolve issues?
Right.
No matter how small or large it is, that continuous improvement model needs to be a part of every function within the organization.
Yeah, because otherwise it turns into something with no credibility that no one's going to buy into. And, you know, something that we say is we can never be a continuous improvement organization unless we're full of people who are on their own continuous improvement paths, right? And that's not just, you know, reading sort of self-help books and educating yourself in your off hours, but it's also getting better at your job or making your processes better. And I love how you kind of talked about that as a, what did you call it? Like a kind of just an approach to, you know, an operational approach. It's kind of this mentality, this is just how we do things. And I think, you know, I think you were kind of proposing some type of a, you know, you said standard operating procedure, but really kind of articulating what a continuous improvement process looks like on a principled basis that then can be applied to, you know, disparate parts of the organization and sort of different process types and, you know, different things. Once that's deployed and people buy into it, like, okay, I guess we are in this mode, I think you very quickly can change the culture of the organization, which is really kind of what we're talking about. If regulators know you as X, Y, or Z, that X, Y, or Z is the culture. It's the reputation. It's the brand of that company, which again is the sum total of all those individual activities of all those people who choose to come there every single day. It's a really powerful thing that I think we can start to lean into and start to model as compliance folks, because we're in this sort of complex role. We have to juggle all these things. We're dealing with, you know, the hard stuff, which is the regulations and do we meet these rules and how do we sort of exist in these different jurisdictions. And we also, to your point, have to be really good at the soft stuff, the influence, the persuasion, right? Because you have to get someone to, you know, behave in a way that's compliant, so to speak, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when we think about kind of the next 10 years, like, I don't know, you have that crystal ball with you, yeah? Can you pull that out? Like as you think about the next 10 years, it's 2030, we're talking again. What do you think has changed in the compliance game? What mentalities have changed? What sort of structures are in place? What is the sort of, you know, the standard operating procedure, so to speak, of compliance with respect to the different groups that they touch, the different vendors that they interact with? Where do you see it all kind of going?
Well, I think that the regulators are going to be putting heavy mandates on vendors. That's first and foremost. We haven't gotten there yet, but I see it evolving in that direction where they are doing inspections of those vendors. They're requesting on the regular proof of validation, constant continuous improvement, continuous application to the upcoming regulatory standards, and how are they addressing those on behalf of their clients and making sure that it starts really with the technology solutions that we use. Another thing that I see, and just in going through the remediation of systems right now, you know, something that we won't see in 10 years are paper test scripts, you know, execution, sign off of paper test scripts. That will not happen. I don't think that will be a conversation in the next 2 years with most of these organizations where they're having to go back and review paper scripts. I think at some point those are going to go away. And I was actually truly shocked at the sheer volume of paper scripts we still had. And being able to rely heavily on, you know, audit and application of the software proving that validation, having, you know, organizations that have a test factory in-house, really. These are resources that are focused on regulatory requirements. They recognize what functionality needs to be within those tools to prove that they are regulatorily compliant across the board. Having migration factories, the same. These are resources that are experts in migrating software and data from one place to another and making sure at the end that it is safe and compliant. Those are things that I think organizations don't mostly have in-house right now. A lot of it is outsourced, which is okay as long as those resources are familiar with the systems within the organization. It works fine. That model can be completely outsourced as long as they are focused on, you know, the client and how their systems need to operate. So, you know, I've proven that those models work. It's really hard to get some of these organizations to digest that and why that's a good thing. But to be able to bring expertise in, and that is their focus, is, you know, plug and play. This is a migration. We're migrating a database from this cloud environment to this cloud environment. And these are the things that need to happen as a result of that. You know, they notify users, they go through the process, they migrate the data over the weekend or whatever the case may be. They send out notification once the migration is complete. They have ensured in that process that they've tested everything, that it is sufficiently secure and that they're handing it over in good hands, and have a backup strategy. Those skills in those resources are of critical importance. So having a model like that in-house means that you send the application or the project through that process and you are comfortable with the fact that they know what they're doing and they're able to deliver that for you. So, I think there's a lot of evolution that's going to happen with these cloud platforms. And I have a hard time believing that there will be anything that will be, locally installed anymore in 10 years. I think it's all going to be cloud.
Yeah. What's that going to look like? I mean, it's probably going to be a lot more, it's just going to allow for a lot more flexibility. The wall between sort of vendor and client will probably continue to dissolve more. Vendors will be more entrenched, hopefully more collaborative, sort of smarter things being produced. And how do you see sort of compliance sort of elevating over the next 10 years? Let's just kind of drag it back to the kind of compliance 1.0. It's the turn of the millennium. Sarbanes-Oxley is just coming out. Compliance is kind of this new thing, right? Mm-hmm. Where is it in 2030?
I think in 2030, our regulators globally are going to be aligned. I think with GDPR, I think with, data privacy and the NIST requirements, the security protocols that are required are going to be consistent more across regulators. Yeah. I think there's a lot of discussion around that now. I think ICD-10 and the coding transitions for healthcare systems is an opportunity to kind of illuminate what I'm talking about, because we transitioned to ICD-10, but a lot of the rest of the world is already on ICD-12.
Oh.
So what is inhibiting us from all being aligned with the coding system that we're operating in? And I think that that's an important step that we're going to see in the next 10 years. Where and all of those
how much easier is that to manage, right? When there's
yes,
instead of juggling 50 different jurisdictions, you're juggling two or three. It just simplifies so much and really can clear the way for more of the innovation that's really going to drive the value creation in our respective corners of the world.
Absolutely, and I think with our global, hopefully our global leaders will all get on the same page and sign up to say let's all do this right together.
Good.
I think that's going to make life easier for, healthcare, for pharmaceutical companies providing valuable medicines, for making sure that our technology solutions are aligned with every global regulator, and we're not having to have a custom solution for each country. I think that's essential, and I think that's where we're going.
Yeah, compliance in sort of the healthcare space is kind of the cutting edge of it, I think. Because it's so much higher acuity, there's so much more kind of in it. And, many times folks in these higher, these areas that have much more, regulation and so forth, they're really making a lot of these innovations that, many of the less regulated industries end up kind of catching up with a couple of years later.
Yes. I agree.
So phenomenal. Great job with that, crystal ball. So that's working still. Phenomenal. So put that aside and let's pull that time machine of yours out. And we're going to go back 20 years and talk to the young Karen. And what advice would you give her?
I would say, to be open-minded to change. That was the most difficult lesson I had to learn 20 years ago, is to be open-minded to change. It's great to be organized and have processes in place, but to have those very rigid makes it difficult to grow. And I think that organizations have started to do that a bit, but it's a very slow process for them. If someone provides feedback to me now, I take it a different way. I don't take it as judgment or criticism. I take it as an opportunity to improve. 20 years ago, I probably did not come into it with the same mindset.
And what caused you to change that? Like, those are two big changes, right? One is, you're somebody who's very put together. You're somebody who's, you probably don't speak out of turn a lot. Your I's are dotted, your T's are crossed. You're kind of on top of your game. And so people like that, I think they put so much of themselves into whatever they're doing. Sometimes that criticism or sometimes that feedback can feel like criticism. I mean, I get it. So yeah. what, like what was the catalyst for this new mentality that says, hey, I need protocols, I need processes and stuff, but these need to be a little bit flexible. And, you know, I can take this feedback now for what it's meant to be, an opportunity to improve. Like, those are two massive lessons that have probably been, you know, jet fuel to make you elevate to the position that you're in now. What were the kind of catalysts for those mentality changes, if you can remember?
Sure. I think it really started about 10 years ago when I was converging an 8-hospital healthcare system into a unified enterprise platform because of regulatory requirements. In doing that, you know, we started out with 900 plus applications. We needed to decile that and have it consistent across the organization. It was a very hard lift. And in doing this, we had to have workshops where all the systems were put up on post-its around the wall in the room, and all of the technology leaders were at the table advocating for keeping their applications. And, you know, I came in with a process out of my PMBOK 101 with how do we do this best? And I kind of had to throw those notes out the window and say, all right, I've got a stack of post-it notes. Let's just put a parking lot up. Let's put priorities up on the wall and let's start putting these things up there. And let's, you know, look at what does the system do? Why are you adamant that you want to keep it? What functionality does it have that you feel like you want to hang on to? And can we find this consistently across the board? And then just starting to decile down to a manageable list, and we got down to 100 applications. We agreed on an enterprise data warehouse. We agreed that the healthcare system needed one unified electronic health record because they were all on different systems.
Wow.
It was a heavy lift and a very large financial hit to the organization, but the implications financially in the long run would have been far greater. So hard conversations, a lot of arguing back and forth. It took multiple sessions to get us to that point. But I learned that you have to be open-minded. You have to listen to everyone that is impacted by that decision and understand, is it just a personal choice? Does it impact how they manage their work from day to day? Or are they getting ready to retire and they don't want to make a decision? They just throw it to the curb, you know? Where are they in that process? So learning to get into the minds of these people that are providing this resistance and understanding how to navigate that water so that the end game is something that works for everyone.
You said so many great words in there. You said, I have to really understand. You have to really listen. You have to get into the minds of the people that are going to be using these things. Just another example of like being forced to like collaborate, right? You're being forced to sort of shatter these structures that, you know, served you for a time to get you to where you were at. But now you're in this new circumstance where it's like, this wasn't in the textbook. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, exactly.
Collaboration with 900 applications. That's a crazy, I mean, you know, understatement of the year is calling that a heavy lift. Like, that's an insane amount of collaboration, influence, right? Like compromise that would need to be done, balancing of risks versus operational implication. Like, it's so much, such a massive ball of yarn that you had to go through. And so funny how like those crucibles end up having such an impact on us and like changing how we view the world and really kind of adding dimensions to the kind of impact that we can make. That's great. So those are phenomenal takeaways. Where can people find you, Karen? People want to follow up with you, pick your brain some more.
But obviously, I'm on LinkedIn. Happy to communicate via LinkedIn. There is also a GXP Cloud Compliance initiative coming up next month that I'm a part of. I'm one of the speakers on that panel.
Oh, cool.
This is specifically around SaaS cloud compliance for GXP. Those are just a few of the things that I've gotten involved in over the last few years, and I continue to be invited to these consortiums because, I think me being so passionate about seeing these things more seamless mm-hmm. is very important. And, it helps other organizations to evolve their thinking and their thought process and how we work together globally to try to find a solution that just makes life easier, because it really does eventually impact, you know, the person on the ground,
Person
that is picking up the prescription bottle and saying, I have to take this every day. What if something goes wrong? What do I do? You know, those are things that are important. And, you know, this is kind of what drives what I do every day.
Well, I love it. This was a really fun conversation. I appreciate your candor and your just sharing so much of your experience and your background and perspective with us. I mean, this is really what thought leadership is, right? Hey, here's a new thought and here's the leadership, me stepping out and giving the message and telling people about it and trying to change the lines of thinking and change the lenses that other people see the world through so that we can start to elevate this thing and really kind of make this stuff more seamless, make our impact more bigger. I'm kidding. More important.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thank you for having me. This was a great conversation.
Absolutely.